still clearing inside.
Sounds from police messages as they arrived at the scene of the SPU shooting. So this week ends with a gun tragedy. As we've been talking about all morning, a 19-year-old man died at Seattle Pacific University. Two others wounded in the hospital in different levels of recovery. Police believe Aaron Ibarra, who was not an SPU student, acted alone. He entered Otto Miller Hall with a shotgun Thursday afternoon while he was reloading a student, John Meese, 22-year-old SPU engineering student and building monitor, blasted Ibarra with pepper spray. Then he tackled him. The president of Seattle Pacific University had praise this morning for John Meese. He told Bill Radke that Daniel Martin said that told Bill Radke that the student put himself in harm's way when he subdued the active shooter on campus.
We challenge our students to live life beyond themselves, and certainly the student that apprehended the gunman certainly was doing that. Our vision statement says engage the culture and change the world. Well, the world was changed yesterday for a lot of people, but because of a selfless act, the world is continuing for many, many others.
President of Seattle Pacific University, Daniel Martin. Knute Berger is here. He writes the Mossback column at Crosscut. Eli Sanders is here. He's been up all night working for The Stranger. Joni Balter is here. She hosts Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Good to see you all.
Good morning.
Good to see you.
So this is one of those things now where we look at what happened and now we start asking questions. And just to the point, though, interesting and sort of telling us where we live in the world today, that notion that SPU and SPD had been working on these plans. All institutions have plans like this. Remember when we had to go off the air because of the fire drill a couple of weeks ago? All institutions now are prepared for emergencies. That's a good thing, but it's when they're man-caused, it's also tragic.
Well, the preparedness had quite a lot to do with this not being a whole lot worse. And everyone's going to be talking about pepper spray here for a time because, you know, the other side of the gun safety argument is that you needed someone armed in that situation. But here's a story that happened here. And the story is that someone was armed with pepper spray and changed the ultimate outcome of this event.
Yeah.
Which is a big deal.
Yeah.
And very brave.
Yeah, very brave.
Also leading to the preparation for this and maybe the placement of pepper spray at the student monitor's station, I don't know. But leading to all of this is the familiarity with this kind of event. I mean, this is very sadly not new. Anna Menard has a very good post up at The Stranger's blog slog this morning, and I tweeted it out. It might be easier to find it that way. But it says this, and it talks about the desire for there to be not one more shooting. That's always expressed after these shootings. And here we are with one more. And Anna says, this is the world we've built, and we should really start coming to terms with that.
I was thinking about, I read that piece too. It was a great piece. I read it. And also comparing that with the father who was chastised after his son was murdered in California for saying, this is about guns, can't we have this be part of the conversation? And many people said, well, he used a knife, he used this. So we have these tragedies. We are part of that world now, it seems.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Joni pointed out, you know, it's a case study in the effectiveness of pepper spray and, you know, and ending a violent incident. The guy had to stop and reload. It's an example of the difference that can be made between somebody having endless rounds for a semi-automatic weapon versus a shotgun or some other gun with limited number of rounds. The problem is that the legislation, I mean, you pointed out that everybody has a safety plan, and that's great. That is a positive outcome from these kinds of negative events. The problem where things stall is when you get to the legislative process of gun control or limiting the kinds of firearms people can have. We always have a legislative initiative. In this case, we have one before the fact with the Hanauer ballot measure and on background checks. It's going to be coming up. But we also have, you know, after the fact, soul searching. You know, why haven't we done more sooner? And that's kind of where we consistently fall down, is actually taking steps to mitigate these things.
Of course, we have two competing initiatives. One will remove all background checks unless there's a federal mandate on background checks, basically.
So we do. We have the two competing initiatives. Both will be on the November ballot. I recently wrote about them for Bloomberg View. And what's interesting, so one expands the background checks to online and private sales. And the other just says, no, hold at, like you said, hold at what we have now, which is the licensed folks have to conduct the background checks. So when I interviewed Nick Hanauer the other night for Civic Cocktail, this was before this, even though the TV show itself ran right as this was unfolding. And I just asked him, I said, so why expanded background checks? Why now? And he would just sort of, and Knut was there too, was talking about how, are you kidding? People are sick and tired of this repeat drama. This drama repeats. People are tired of being shot. Now, he didn't have the benefit of knowing about this event because it was the day before. But I have seen so many, we've all seen so many similarities. Frequently, when these things start, they say there's probably two people, one or more. That's because they get conflicting reports about who's holding what and who went in what direction. It's almost always, you know, a distraught young person around somewhere in their 20s that is the suspect in these. Then there's the people having to deal with the aftermath, the huddling, the hugging, the prayers, the everything. It is becoming such a sickening routine.
And it's certain to be brought into the debate over these two dueling gun control measures. I don't want to get too far ahead of what's actually known about the suspect, but there are reports out that say he was fascinated with Columbine, perhaps that he even maybe took a trip down to Columbine as part of this fascination to see the site of the school. If that's true, and if being a strong word in that sentence, but if that's true, could anyone reasonably argue that this person should have access to a weapon in Washington State without a background check?
You know, the other thing that has been pointed out in it as what happened is that Mayor Murray made his comments and then went to a vigil for a double homicide in the South End. I mean, this is new to SPU yesterday, but not new to the South End. Another two murders had taken.
Yeah, not even it wasn't even the first murder of the week.
Yeah,
as far as that goes, and I think that's where some serious soul searching has to be done, and understanding why these happen, but not let one event overshadow the other. There has to be some kind of equity, I think, in the way we look at these things.
And in fact, there were more people killed in the South End shooting, although more people actually shot at the SPU shooting. There were two people killed, both of them, the stranger is reported, gay men in the Central District shooting on Sunday. In the SPU incident, there's one person killed and three other people injured.
Including one critically.
Right. The mayor has, I think, done a very strong job of demonstrating a sense of equity in this, actually. He was at the scene of the SPU shooting yesterday. He gave a statement. There was a vigil being held at SPU, but instead of staying for that, the mayor left and went to the vigil that was also being held, the sort of competing vigil, to use an unfortunate word.
Of course, they weren't competing, of course, because who knew?
Because other one was planned before, to be
fair. But competing in the sense that there's only one mayor and there are limited attention spans in the city and in the general public. And so it's a very strong statement for the mayor at a moment when national attention is focused on Seattle, excuse me, because of this shooting, to leave the scene of the shooting and go to the scene of an older, earlier in the week, shooting in the Central District and say, I'm going to stand here as well and try to remind people that there is equivalence in the loss and lives here.
You know, when Anna Menard was writing that column, towards the end of that column, that terrible repetition and sameness, and the media becomes part of that, right? We all become role players in this. Even those of us who are watching, we all become this role playing. We all take on these roles, and we don't want to, but we almost are forced to by the way the stories unfold.
Well, just to be the maybe hopeful about this, that something might be different. The initiative here in Washington is not left to lawmakers who have a problem voting the way their constituents feel on this, because this vote is up to the public. But we have seen before that if enough money comes in and enough doubt is cast about an initiative, especially with a competing measure on the ballot ahead of 594 that starts with language about confiscating guns, which is not even part of it, but that is sort of mind-altering when you're facing your ballot, you know. So that's one thing. And then one really interesting thing came up in the California legislature. And as you know, California has pretty tight gun laws. But one idea that is now being considered in California after their event, what, only 2 weeks ago or something, because there's such frequency of these, is this idea of family members and law enforcement being able to ask a judge for a restraining order for somebody who seems to be a danger or who seems to be violent. And so this has not passed or anything like that. It's just three lawmakers down there that have proposed this. But it's a different approach to instead just saying, you know, any of the other legislative approaches that have come up. It's more like in the vein of a domestic violence kind of restraining order.
When you talk about the roles that people so easily fall into, you also end up very quickly in a sort of chicken and egg argument. The shooting draws out the media, but does repeated, excessive, sometimes media coverage of these events give young men who are distraught and looking for a warped sense of glory something to imagine for themselves? Or does the culture in some other way contribute to this? Or does our broken mental health system? And what leads what? You can spiral into that for a very long time, and we actually always do. The way, in my view, to break out of that is with sensible policy that actually addresses the increased lethality of a disturbed person like this, which is gun control.
Well, go ahead.
There were two, I thought, very interesting things that Nick Hanauer said about the gun initiative the other day. And one was, he said it's not a mental health thing.
Yeah.
And his argument on that is there are just as many crazy people in Britain. The difference is they can't put their hands on guns. So it's a gun thing, not a crazy thing. Second, one of his strategies for this initiative, and this is something very interesting to keep in mind, is that whether or not it passes, the amount of money he's putting into it will force gun advocates, particularly, say, the NRA, to spend heavily to defeat it. He thinks it has a very good chance of passage. And part of the strategy is to create, to drain their resources that they might put into other races, political races, drain their resources as much as possible. So he's thinking very strategically about it. In other words, he thinks it will pass. He wants it to pass. If it's an expensive fight that keeps the NRA from spending money in other states for other candidates, all the better.
Well, a couple of things. You know, clearly if 594 was on the ballot in 2016, which is a sort of a more liberal turnout year, that would be preferable, but they filed for this year. And so that is one thing. I also wanted to add this other point that I saw this morning on Facebook where folks were talking about this event. And one of the hashtags is don't name the shooter. And I believe that's, and I don't know the answer to this, actually. I was trying to check in with those folks, but I think it's not to give them that big adrenaline rush for, you're now famous in this weird way, but you're now famous, you're now known.
That's interesting because, of course, we don't name the victims in this case at this point, but the name of the shooter came out right away.
And the Seattle Police Department, now that you mentioned this, in its press conference yesterday evening, the assistant police chief who led the press conference made a point of trying to redirect the media's attention from the shooter and questions about the shooter to the bravery of multiple people, he pointed out, at Seattle Pacific University,
yeah,
not just the first man to intervene, although he was very brave, and to the reaction as a from the community as a whole. But I as a member of the media, I guess as a citizen, I don't I feel an urge to resist that redirection. I think we can hold both things in our mind at once. And I think it's important to understand who it is that does something like this and why to the extent that we can. And that's a very important role for the media to play.
It's interesting, too. These things become a lesson in policing to some degree, which is that, of course, you know, we're under a consent decree. The department has been accused of excessive force. Some of the officers are suing, saying that they don't want to have to second guess themselves in crisis situations. Most people's instinct when there's gunfire is to run and hide. There are very few people who actually have the guts to run to the gunfire, to run to the problem, like apparently this young man did at the thing. And it highlights, in a way, from the law enforcement standpoint, the fact that this is what they do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they have to do, and that there are situations where that kind of split second action and intervention is required. It's what we pay them for.
Interesting that the hero in this case was the monitor for the building. He was also responding to his own training.
There also has been a lot of talk in the context of police reform about police feeling hamstrung about what kind of reaction they can bring in a split second, about the split second decisions that they have to make all the time. This pointed out for me that sometimes a less lethal intervention is sufficient and can be deployed in a split second.
Well, isn't it interesting that we have this hero responding so quickly and using just, you know, sort of rudimentary tools of, you know, pepper spray? And we've also seen this on airplanes where, you know, the passengers, you know, sort of like the big guys on the plane now, sort of all, they never had a conversation, but they seem to say that if something were to happen on a plane, that folks would act, individuals would act.
You know, just before the break, you know, you mentioned that he had a shotgun and a knife, and he had to reload because the shotguns, I imagine it was a two-shelled shotgun. And the difference between that and if he had had automatic weapons. That will be a conversation over the next few weeks, I imagine. But will we have the conversation that says, and therefore, can we ban, automatic weapons, high-velocity rounds? I mean, we've almost moved, President Obama included, we moved away from that conversation because the NRA was so powerful in cowing people. They still are.
They still are. And that at the local level as well as the national level, and by local I mean the state level, where you have Democrats elected in swing districts who are not going to take anti-gun positions.
You know, John Stewart on The Daily Show did a pretty nice package yesterday before this had reached them. And it was about the Stand Your Ground laws, and in particular in Texas, where the more fringe gun group got mad at the NRA when the NRA said, don't bring your guns into Chili's. That's just not polite. That's not good etiquette. And the OTC, what I think they're called, the OTC, said, forget that. We're gonna take you down, NRA. And pretty soon the NRA backed off. They backed off on that criticism, and they said, you know, we support what these folks are doing as well. So it's even within the gun lobby itself, the fringe
dismissed the
weapon.
Individual who wrote that email.
That's
about
right.
It. And they said, you know, just an employee who didn't understand type thing.
Yeah. Well, all right. We'll take a break. But we end on that note that there was a few heroes, who, just like you said, who responded by moving forward and acting. And that was pretty amazing. This is The Week in Review. It's The Week in Review on KUOW Seattle. Knute Berger writes the Mossback column at crosscut.com. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. And Joni Balter writes for Bloomberg View and does KUOW news analysis.
There you go.
There you go. This week started on a historic note. Lowest paid workers in Seattle could reach the nation's highest minimum wage over the next 7 years.
9 in favor, none opposed.
We did it. Workers did this.
Yeah.
That's Shama Sawant. I wonder if she was. I just was listening to the applause. That was how the week began, with a lot of positive. If you were in another country and you're looking at Seattle headlines and Seattle bylines, you think, "Wow, this city is frightening in the amount of news it's generating." But historic vote on Monday by the city council.
Truly historic, and you know the way that it is slowly rolling out. It has gotten much support from a lot of folks. This was sort of Nick Hanauer week, so we interviewed him about this as well.
Well, remind us why.
Because of the minimum wage and
because Nick Hanauer was one of the initial sort of movers and shakers and putting the money behind this.
Actually, it says that he came up with the $15 figure because it was in between these two numbers, and that just how, you know, how hard that committee, that task force was to be on, how hard everybody worked, and how sort of amazing it was that it all came together. It's fascinating to me that now, here at the end of the week, we find out that the charter amendments that would undo this or make the $15 minimum wage start earlier, if those happen, actually can't even go on the ballot. If they come from citizens, if they came from the council, it would be different. But if they come from citizens, they can't even go on the ballot until an odd year, 2015, which is interesting to me because the city council was trying. One of the reasons they moved the start date of the whole slow rollout from January to April was because they had this great unknown of the November vote.
Yeah, they didn't realize.
And I just found this. You know, I
they hadn't read their own charter amendment rules.
They hadn't read. I called Pete Holmes, the city attorney, as he was landing in Denver this morning, and said, "Huh? How come the council didn't know this?" And he said, "We really had to look. They had to look back to 1936 law to remember this." Oh well.
You know, in terms of the politics of this now, it wasn't all sunshine before the vote either. And here's city council member Bruce Harrell. He got tired of catcalls from the audience at one point.
That's crap. That is absolutely crap. And I will say that if you want big business to listen to you, listen to business. The voice of the employee and the voice of the employer are intertwined. One cannot exist without the other.
And that was the motive by the end of the week with that group you're talking about that wants to gather signatures for this another charter amendment. Small business group announced their campaign yesterday.
Forward Seattle, representing the local independent business community, has filed a proposed charter amendment to establish a new minimum wage rate for the city of Seattle.
So we're gonna have dueling amendments, perhaps. They have to gather, 31,000 signatures by the end of the month. So,
but that's a piece of cake. You can do that if you really want to do that. That's not hard. What's weird about it all is that it wouldn't take place for, you know, 16 months or 17 months. Somebody catch me on that. And then one more weirdness, as if it wasn't weird enough, initiative guru Tim Iman wants to file an initiative that would undo the whole party.
Oh, he did. He filed it.
That would undo the whole party and say that the state can set the minimum wage.
Wants the minimum wage to be uniform and consistent. The Fair and Uniform Minimum Wage Initiative, one of five he filed on Wednesday, by the way.
Well, I thought that was interesting because so many people have argued that the minimum wage being raised is kind of an apocalypse for business. And Tim Iman's initiative suggests, no, it's a competitive advantage for Seattle. You know, we have to stop it. Which is it? I mean, it was interesting. Again, going back to Hanauer, I asked him this question about making Seattle fairer, and he said, you know, my support of this is not based on fairness. I'm a capitalist. I think capitalism can work better. And, you know, Shama Sawant is, you know, says that it's the workers who did it, but some really rich millionaire business people got behind this thing, too. And the argument is from their perspective, from, say, Hanauer's perspective, is that workers who are making good money become good customers, and you create a righteous cycle where business flourishes and everybody wins, or if not everybody, most people win. And, you know, that it's he's basically saying we're doing it because it's good business. And so on that score, I'm glad Tim Iman agrees. From a political standpoint, I think Ed Murray handled this thing beautifully, smartly. as from a pure politics situation, and now, you know, if he's put in the position of having to defend Seattle from Tim Iman, my goodness, what a great political gift to Ed Murray. I mean, no politician in Seattle is going to hurt himself fighting Tim Iman.
And Ed has spent a lot of years in Olympia wanting a fight against Tim Iman that he can actually win.
As opposed to the ones he's had where they were pushed back.
What were the
Seattle
other four?
Legislators kept losing.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. What were the other four measures about? Is this a case of Tim Iman saying nobody's called me lately?
Well, I'll look it up. I had forgotten it. Do you know what some of them are?
I don't.
I don't know the answer, but I was going to say one can only hope this is finally the initiative where Tim Iman will be forced to explain to the rural counties in Washington State why he keeps wanting them to vote against their own economic interest. This is a measure that would raise the wages of people in the counties that regularly vote in favor of these Iman initiatives. And if this goes forward, if the initiative actually gets on the ballot, then I would hope that the debate will force him to tell them why they should earn less than $15. What's his argument?
Well, the other thing is that conservatives usually argue for local control. You know, and moving government down to the lowest level so that city councils and counties have much more say in things. And now he's filing an initiative which does exactly, precisely the opposite. So, well, I mean, not that we look to Tim Iman for complete consistency on all things.
No. To go back to the council meeting that you referenced at the beginning and the tenor of that, and your mention about what a busy week this was for Seattle media, Anna Menard was at that council hearing also. And she pointed out in a news lead in The Stranger this week that this win is a triumph for an approach that is not Seattle nice. That is, in a way, what Bruce Harrell was pushing back against. People don't come to council meetings usually and interrupt the speakers and lead cheers in the way that occurred during this debate. And the willingness of Sawant and the people in the 15 Now movement to be a little more bare-knuckled, not go too far over the line, but be a little more bare-knuckled about their politics, was a big factor in shaping a final agreement that was more to their liking, not perfectly to their liking, but more in line with what they wanted.
Well, that's why the that quote that you played by Bruce Harrell was so interesting, because even when folks are rude to one another here, there's often this sort of, okay, we'll just roll with it. We'll do the whole passive-aggressive thing and not respond. And for Bruce Harrell to get up and say what the other seven council members were thinking was, you know, we are passing a $15 minimum wage. We are leading the nation in this. And then we're being called sort of corporate stooges in so many words. Not that those weren't the exact words, but they were, you know, words to that effect. For him to stand up in a council meeting, this was a moment for Seattle, because he's just saying, don't you dare. Don't you dare.
I have a question about that as well, because C.R. Douglas and Erica Barnett were talking this week on The Record and sort of mentioned, was there a sense of the council being cowed at this point by Shama Sawant and her supporters? I mean, did they get boxed into a place where they were afraid to anger them?
I actually see something slightly different going on. I think that Shama Sawant and her supporters did a very good job of creating a price for compromising too far and creating momentum behind the idea of hanging tough with the agreement that the mayor's committee reached, even though it upset a lot of people on all sides. But I think what's actually going on is something a little more sophisticated, and that's Shama Sawant creating a space for herself to compromise. If she stands at the city council and says, this is wrong, I agree with the people in the audience, this is an imperfect deal, I'm going to offer, as she did, amendments that are right in line with what the advocates in the audience want, and they're all going to be voted down 8-1 with Shama Sawant as the only person losing. She is simultaneously a martyr for the cause because she kept on losing with those amendments, and a pragmatic advocate who will take the best deal that she can get.
Yeah, I think that analysis is right on. I mean, I don't think this thing would have happened as quickly as it did without Shama Sawant. It may not have happened at all. And I think Ed Murray has, and I think he was onto this. He not only believes in raising the minimum wage in principle, but I think he saw good politics in it by doing something kind of Clintonian, which is when you have rivals or opponents who have a point of view, you embrace and extend what they want to do. And so I give her a lot of credit both for being the spark plug and also for being willing to make the compromise move at the end as opposed to marginalizing herself with having it be an 8-1 vote with her holding out. I mean, it is a victory for her, but I think it's also a victory for the establishment, the sort of pro-capitalist progressives in Seattle. I don't think most people are hardcore socialists. They want this thing was worked out in incremental steps with a committee through debate and compromise. That's classic Olympia stuff. That's classic Seattle stuff. It just happened on a time frame that's not the usual Seattle process, and I think she's partly responsible for that.
And we had predicted on this very show that it would be a 9-0 vote a couple of times for that reason. There is sort of a casualty cost, perhaps, of some of the language that was used, but probably the council will get over it and move onward.
So if you're a city council member wannabe or a member, given what happened here, how do you start strategizing? Who do you align yourself with as going forward when we're going to have district races and groups have revealed themselves to be powerful across the city, not just within the lines of a district?
You align yourself with the policy that the council passed unanimously, and you run on that, even if you were skeptical, because this has polled so strongly citywide. I don't know how any politician who wants to be reelected looks at this and says, even with districts, which, you know, makes you responsible to a smaller part of the city if you're just representing that district. But still, I don't know how anyone looks at the polling and sees otherwise than that they need to support this.
And interestingly, the district elections will be the same ballot time as these charter amendments if they live to see that day.
Yeah, well, everybody who wants to run again, virtually, except for the people who would run for the at-large seats, you know, has to reevaluate their relationship with their district. And it's going to be very important for people to the city council members to begin looking at the city in a very different way. And some would argue a more parochial way. Some would say a much more grassroots sensitive way, and a little of both. And what will be interesting as we enter, because these elections are happening in 2015, the first phase is happening in 2015, it's all on the table now. When the next budget comes out, how are we going to see neighborhood projects funded? How are we going to see wheeling and dealing and money being moved around? How do we see people beginning to knock on doors in districts that maybe they haven't done that for a long time or whatever? So it's going to be interesting, and there will be I would predict that all the city council people will have opponents. I don't think this new system is going to be one in which people run unopposed or virtually unopposed for seats. There are a lot of groups of all political stripes in the city that see this as a great opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be – if you're a supporter of Shama Sawant, you have to look at what she's accomplished and have sort of a new idea of how to organize and who to reach in order to motivate people to come to the poll.
Well, and she is seizing on that moment by by encouraging people to rethink their commitment to the Democratic Party, look at her Socialist Alternative Party as the party that got it done. And that's part of this kind of, if you want to argue there's a political monoculture in Seattle, it has to do with the Democrats. It's essentially being a one-party town in terms of Democrats. She wants to break that up.
All right. Here's a couple of emails just before. Kathy wrote, I disagree with the commentator who felt that knowing who the shooter is and why he did it is worthwhile news. Yes, it's worthwhile for law enforcement, but not for the public. Shooters do not deserve to be in the news over and over again, eulogized in a sick way. Concentrate on the victims and the heroic actions of the people who brought him down. And then a second one, dismayed that you, as well as all who discuss the availability of guns in the wrong hands, avoid the elephant in the room we're in our society, which is that guns are the problem. Well, I don't think we did avoid that problem.
I think we addressed that one. I made that point.
Yeah. And I know you want to respond, so I'll let you have a more pointed one. disagree with Eli's comment. I'd like to weigh in and disagree on two levels. At this point, with so many deadly shooting events playing out in similar ways, Sherry writes, I think the media has a role in evaluating the mindset of a person set on killing, but not to glorify in detail the ad nauseum, the background of each individual killer. We should know the causes and the beginnings and the drives, but in a way that provokes us to watch for the roots of the concern in our communities, not like watching piranhas in a tank at the aquarium. That's from Sherry.
I actually agree with almost every single sentence in Sherry's email, maybe not the ones at the beginning. And I want to...
Well, that's for sure. She's talking about you.
Well, she's talking about the motivation and the overall impact of these stories that I was describing as important. And the import of them is exactly as she says at the end, to understand the drives and motivations, because perhaps that helps us craft policy, change the culture. The first emailer who talked about the media eulogizing shooters, that's wrong. That is not what the media is up to normally with looking into the background of shooters. And to silence the media through an attempt to craft any exploration of a shooter's life as a eulogy is disingenuous and wrong.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back with Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Knute Berger, Luke Burbeck will join us. The Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. You're tuned to The Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scherr with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger. Just a few quick stories. Peter Steinberg, it was written in the paper this week, has a contract through with Ed Murray with the city. You said there was a big non-story, Skip?
Well, I thought so. I didn't think there was any suggestion of wrongdoing. It was published in the Seattle Times under kind of a watchdog tag.
It was the Times watchdog.
The implication was that there was something wrong here. I mean, you had the mayor hiring one of his allies who happens to be an expert in a subject that needs research, and going through, you know, whatever the legal bidding. I mean, if you have a problem with the way no-bid contracts, the fact that they exist, then get rid of them. But if they exist and exist for a purpose, which they do, I just didn't see a problem. And I thought, the story, and this was previously reported by Publicola months ago, was this research project. And I think it's a very valid one to look at the actual measurable effects of neighborhood policy and sustainability policies and find out what's working, because we're facing a massive revamping of the comp plan.
Steve, and Peter Steinbrück was a politician. He was city council member. He's an architect. So the theory is that though he threw his support behind Ed Murray to be mayor.
Can I just beg to differ here for a second?
And please
do. That would just be simply that if it's going to look funny, what you should do is have a open bid. It would be very simple. It wouldn't take very long, and it would do away with much of this. You know, there is this cynicism. I was just reading the E.J. Dionne book from long ago about why Americans hate politics. I mean, you want things to be as clean and above board. He may ultimately be the right exact person for that. Just do the bids.
And the mayor is no stranger to an open public selection process.
93-year-old man parachuted into Normandy for the second time. He did it 70 years ago. And 900 of the last surviving World War II veterans joined 20 world leaders in northern France to mark the 70th anniversary of D-Day landings. This is the anniversary. We need to note it because of what all those people did, a vanishing generation. I knew some veterans of the war. I know you've known your share as well, right?
And we call them dads.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what
yeah. My uncle was a co-pilot in those B-17s that flew out of England. So,
Obama, Putin, and Ukraine's incoming president are going to theoretically be face to face when they're at Normandy. So, all right. One more controversy, and this was I thought Stewart. Apparently, I get all my news from John Stewart. I thought John Stewart encapsulated this really well. This little montage that Stewart put together about the coverage of the Bowie Bergdahl release.
Across the board, this is a magnificent, wonderful story.
They have, in fact, negotiated with terrorists.
You do not negotiate with terrorists.
We leave no one behind.
So there's your, again, the stories, you know, we started this show talking about the stories. Here's how the story is. Cliche versus cliche. Negotiate with terrorists. Leave no one behind.
I'm with leave no one behind and mete out the justice if it's appropriate later. That makes more sense. You can't do this in the sort of in the middle of all this. You have to bring the person home. If Bo Bergdahl is a deserter, we'll talk about it. We have procedures for that, and we always have.
I'm with President Obama, who I believe I read yesterday said, this is somebody's son. I think that pretty much says it all.
Yeah. Do you mind that five active Taliban folks were released from Guantanamo?
Well, I love how they said aging. How old? Are they really slowed?
Well, apparently, we've had trouble getting rid of prisoners in Guantanamo.
Yeah, and, well, we still
and,
do.
These guys were slated for eventual release anyway. And, I agree with Charles Krauthammer and David Brooks. I think the president made the right decision. And I think even some conservatives are grudgingly willing to admit that. This is just the whole reaction to this thing, I think, has just been the classic. I mean, you know, if President Obama went out and solved global warming and the hunger problem and the housing problem, they would still be criticizing him for everything he does. He can't touch anything. It's ridiculous.
Besides it being good talking points for very red districts, any political fallout for Obama over this?
Well, the senators who weren't called seem to think that the administration keeps putting them in this defensive position in a tough year for Democrats, 2014, that there's just too many of the Veterans Administration events of the week earlier, plus this, plus the slow rollout of health care. Although there were some very good numbers on health care this week, that the number of uninsured has really dropped. And that's kind of that's the other side of why Americans hate politics. Politics actually accomplish something. So,
all right. And Seattle Police Chief nominee Kathleen O'Toole, she answered questions for the city council this week. Did we learn anything new?
We learned that she's very, very good in public, which I think we had a hint of from the announcement press conference where she answered reporters' questions. Was that 2 weeks ago, a week and a half? But she is very strong in her public presentation, and she is very good at presenting an open face to the public. And the idea that she has a firm vision that the police department can do better and should be more community-oriented and should be drawn from the community that it serves, while at the same time supporting the work they do.
And finally, the Amazon controversy. As we said, you know, if you were somewhere else and looking at the headlines in Seattle, you would wonder what was happening in the city. But so the Amazon controversy, Amazon versus Hachette, and now Walmart gets in as well, telling people, we'll get you your books. Yeah, Walmart said, we're going to get your books on time.
So they have the on buttons where Amazon does not.
Amazon is fighting with publishers over costs, and so there's delaying going on and pricing wars going on. And Sherman Alexie, who is an author and Luke Burbank's basketball buddy, was on, like that transition, is leading the push against Amazon, touting other authors and other ways people can get books. Look, as somebody who I know sooner or later will be entering the written world,
or at least reading a book someday.
what's your take on what's happening, how Amazon looks and Bezos looks and Sherman Alexie looks?
Well, talk about a liberal brain explosion. If you have to turn to Walmart to get your books because they're standing up for essentially, the authors, or at least they would say they are. That's going to put some people in Seattle in a real twist. But, I am friends with Sherm, and it's funny because I do play in this basketball group that he's in, and it's rare that the basketball email that goes around says, I'm going to be on Colbert tonight talking about the future of publishing if any of you want to tune in. But that was the email that went out. I have a little bit of a hard time getting that down on Amazon, to be honest with you, because I just feel like, I mean, and I'm sure Skip has a much more kind of cogent thought on this than I do as a writer, but I just feel like, you know, somebody at the point at which it's not useful to authors to use Amazon, somebody else will figure something else out, and we, the public, will people utilize that service, right? I mean, I don't want to go all free market on it, but it just seems like Amazon, they have a website where they make books available, and they kind of have the right to charge what they want to charge to make those books available. I mean, that's sort of how I see it.
That's Luke Burbank. He is host of the podcast Too Beautiful to Live. He's also a regular guest on the Wait, Don't Tell Me, and he hosts LiveWire, which is on at 8 o'clock on Friday nights on KOW. It's a show that's performed for a live audience in Portland, Oregon.
Can I just throw a compliment here to the stranger, which has been fairly hilarious about talking about the Amazon PR department? Some really funny things about how, I mean, this is a PR blunder for Amazon. I don't know if they care if they have a PR blunder. I mean, it's sort of, you know, but there's just the fact they just never answer questions. And I really think they should rethink that, especially when I call.
I've successfully and gratefully caught that compliment.
That was very nice.
It was up in the air, and then yeah.
Did you learn anything new about Amazon this week?
Well, I Luke threw down the gauntlet there, challenging me to have a cogent thought. That's unfair, really unfair. But I did learn something from Sherman's Sherman Alexie's appearance on Colbert, which was I thought he pointed out. I think that one of the issues here is that most people think that books are different from other commodities, that you're hurting authors, you're hurting the kind of creative ecosystem. And his point was that most books published today, their success or failure is determined before they ever get to the bookstore. And that has to do with pre-orders, and that has to do with, book sales and promotional stuff. And then there are a lot of young authors with first-time books coming out that are caught in this, fight. The other thing I thought is funny is that, Seattleites are being encouraged to support a bookstore in Portland as their substitute for Amazon. Powell's. And my wife has done that for years. And I've been kind of a holdout in using Amazon from time to time. And now I'm going to have to reconsider.
Another thing.
I will say that the whole Amazon business model is mysterious to me, and the reason I say that is because I had a 600-pound barbecue delivered yesterday in Port Townsend, Washington, at no charge because of Amazon Prime, and I don't know how that works as a business.
And you ordered it the day before.
I actually hadn't even ordered it yet.
No, wait a second.
I mean, I'm trying to imagine the size of the drone that brought
too,
it to
me
you.
Me too. You're lucky that it didn't come in on a drone, because that could have hurt.
Exactly. I mean, it is this constant tension between the incredible convenience. I'm not joking about the barbecue, by the way.
We know.
The incredible convenience that's provided by this company, and yet the, maybe the long-term implications when they are the only store that exists in the world.
Right.
It's worth remembering that there are three parties involved here: the consumer, the publishers, and then the author. And Amazon does not give out author advances. It does not support and nurture writers who are working on their first book or their third. It just
sells. Said the guy working on his first book.
It just sells their final product. So, right. But so to the extent that Amazon's hard bargaining with Hachette and other publishers takes more money from the publishers and puts it into Amazon's pocket and leaves the publishers with less money to spend cultivating writers, people do suffer. The writers suffer and consumers of books suffer.
All right, before I run out of time, this headline, this should have either been on LiveWire first, I would have thought, Luke, or at least even we should have done this. Seattle rapper Sir Mix-a-Lot joins the Seattle Symphony for the 4th Annual Sonic Evolution Concert tonight, blending world premiere works inspired by Seattle music legends. Baby Got Back going classical. What do you think?
Well, we think of Beethoven and Mozart as being so classy because it's, music from a different era, but those guys were writing the Baby Got Back of their time.
It was actually Baby Got Bach, I think.
Oh,
that was nice.
For the win.
Yes.
It only makes sense that Sir Mix-a-Lot would be paired with what was the pop music of its day, right?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Baby Got Bach. All right, Luke Burbank is host of LiveWire and the TBTL podcast, among his various media interests. Joni Balter is host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, contributor to Bloomberg View. Eli Anders, associate editor of The Stranger. Knute Berger, Mossback and contributor to Seattle Magazine, Mossback at crosscut.com. Andy Hirst is our producer. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. People, you once again created a wonderful show. It's always excellent to be talking with you about these issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is The Week in Review from KUOW Seattle.